Awesome. Welcome to another episode of MotoGP Banter India. And like I promised in the last episode, I'm going to try getting as many guests as I can because it's always interesting and it's always a good thing to have someone who I can talk to, converse with, Bato Gyan and Gain Gyan. So this time around, I've got Rishi Agrawal. I don't know, you're Rishi Agrawal or Agarwal? Which Agrawal? Agarwal, superb. So the first time I met Rishi was at a racetrack. And I think it was one of the throttle wide open sessions. I think we were there for a shoot. And that is when I first met Rishi. And I was completely blown away with his motorcycle at first and then by his riding. So I've seen Rishi go full gas around the racetrack more than a couple of times. And it's been amazing. How have you been, dude?
I'm good. I'm good, man. Thank you so much for having me. It's honestly such a pleasure to be here, part of this podcast that I follow, that I really enjoy following. I've been good. Thank you. Yeah, I do remember the first time we met. It was at the racetrack. For me, it was sort of like meeting like an enigma of guys almost, because the Power Drift team was there. And, you know, you've heard about these guys, you've seen their work, and, you know, the first time you get to meet them. So I was excited too.
In fact, I was so impressed by Rishi. I actually told Shumi that we should have Rishi at Power Drift. And Shumi's like, no chance. He's too busy with his own work and you know, his life, and he won't move to Pune, so it won't happen. But the one thing that I really like was when I look at someone and when I look at an addition for the team, I always look at three or four things. One, of course, the knowledge of motorcycle should be extremely high. I mean, you should have worked on your motorcycle and stuff like that. And I've always seen you work with your motorcycle. You change your tires on your own. And that was criteria number one. You should be, an individual should be charming at the very least. You know, even if, you know, I mean, obviously, it's a part of your personality. When you're good looking, you kind of project that onto the screen. And it's always a good connect as well. And second, that communication, and not second, but lastly, it should be communication. I think that's a big key in getting your message across. And I felt you're a perfect fit. So if you guys think people are listening to this, maybe Google Rishi Agarwal, or I'm going to drop a link in my Instagram story. maybe check this boy out and, you know, follow him if you like him. And let me know if you want to see my content.
There are far further popular Rishi Agarwals on YouTube, on Google. I'm sorry. I've tried that once before. Thoroughly disappointed.
Awesome, man. I think the one reason why I wanted Rishi to be a part of this podcast was because, one, because Rishi was following this podcast a lot. Second, I've seen him ride motorcycles. I've seen how he maintains his health. I've never seen him out of shape, and I've always seen him trim and proper. So I think 2-3 reasons, and this episode is something that focuses on health and nutrition, which is so essential to a rider, not just a MotoGP rider, but when you sit on a motorcycle. I think health, nutrition, fitness, all of this comes into play. But before I get there, Rishi, you were a racer, right?
I'm not a racer. I've tried my hand at racing, and it was mainly through the encouragement of Anand and the people at Indy Motard. But yes, I have tried my hand at racing, and I do like a little bit of that competitive environment.
So what were you racing? I mean, you said you tried your hand at racing. What bike was it? Which year was it? Mm-hmm.
So this was 2018, the MRF Challenge at Chennai Racetrack, MMSC. So they had a 2-day event. So they were mainly for the Formula 4 cars or whatever those cars that they had.
Correct.
And the bike races were sort of like just to fill in the gaps and just a little bit of entertainment for the crowd. So it was a 2-day event, the 2 races, 8 laps each. Superb experience. First time ever tried anything like that. I didn't realize how demanding it would be. I've never really been, pushed myself for even 8 laps. If you actually think about it, you have to be 100%. Focused mentally, physically, and I really realized at that time the importance of just to keep yourself physically fit can have so many benefits in an environment like racing or the sport in general.
Which bike were you riding?
I was riding the Aprilia RSV4.
So it was like an open category, is it?
Yeah, it was 1000cc open category.
And there was no cap on the modification bit. Like, you can tune it as much as you can.
Yeah, they had no restriction on what you can do with the bike in terms of tuning aftermarket products. Obviously, you had to keep the integrity of the engine. Couldn't go past 1,000 cc. And I don't think, correct, to be honest, we were at that stage. They were mostly hobbyists. I don't think there were too many serious racing professionals, because it's not a season, really. It's not really a... it's just a one-off event. So I think more of us were just hobbyists taking part.
So where did you qualify and where did you finish?
I qualified second.
Mm-hmm.
That was on day one, which was a Friday. It was sort of like a practice qualifying sort of a thing.
Correct.
And then the first... Sorry, that was, yeah, day one. The early morning was a little bit of a practice qualifying sort of a thing. And the first race was in the evening. So I started race one in second place. I ended up winning that race.
Mm-hmm.
And day two was the second race. So you again start the same place that you qualified and ended up in that one as well.
Superb. So wins on your debut.
Yeah, very fortunate. Beginner's luck, you could say.
Dude, the first time I had, I went racing was with the Apache RTR 200. And that, and mm-hmm. you know, I was pestering the TVS guys for one race. I mean, I was like, hey, you know what? If there's a slot that's empty, bring me in as a wild card. I would just love to try my hand at it. And yeah, this was apparently the final race of the season. And I was up against a bunch of YouTubers. I think there were a couple of professional riders as well, professional journalists. And I'd never raced before. And I think I qualified third or fourth. I don't remember that correctly. Or maybe second or something. And there was the championship leader. He was Shahnawaz Kareem. I don't know if you've heard of him, but he's, I think, one of the instructors at the BMW Motor Art School. Yeah, Shahnawaz. So I had like a 5-lap long, hard battle with Shahnawaz. And I think it was in the second last lap where I mean, till the second last lap, for the first 3-4 laps, I kind of studied what he was doing, where he was going, where he was slowing down. And in the second last lap, mm-hmm. I kind of overtook and maintained my position and won the race. But the reason I say this, but you know what, dude? I remember me just overthinking so much and being at the start line, my heart's beating fast and I'm losing focus, I'm losing energy, I'm losing confidence.
Yeah.
But I think once I got in a flow, I sort of maintained that, didn't realize and probably didn't even have that realization when I crossed the checkered line in the first position. But I think,
dude,
adrenaline.
This is exactly what happened to me.
Dude, adrenaline.
Unbelievable
itself,
adrenaline.
It zaps out so much energy.
Unbelievable.
Right? How?
Dude, I can't tell you. Before the race started, I had an entire liter of water.
Yeah.
I was at the, I mean, I'm saying like literally 5 minutes before the race started because I was feeling so dehydrated. My energy was up, my adrenaline was up, but my energy was down. I was feeling a little nervous.
Correct.
I was at the line, and those 5 minutes that they make you sit on the bike felt so long. My tongue was parched.
Yeah, exactly.
I felt so dehydrated. I don't know what I was doing. Super nervous. The race starts. I make a blunder of the first half a lap. I get overtaken. I get pushed down to fourth place. And then I think my nerves calm down. And then you sort of slowly start getting into the zone. I think it was turn 7 on the first lap, I remember, where I finally felt not jittery anymore. Mm-hmm. And I regained my focus. And I was like, okay, now let's go get this sort of a thing.
Yeah.
But I know exactly what you mean. And those 8 laps went by so fast. I had no idea that it was the last lap. Suddenly, the checkered flag comes out. And you're like, oh, it's done.
Exactly, dude.
The second time around, the next day, I remember, because now it's sort of out of your system first time. Second race felt like an eternity. Those 8 laps felt like I was doing yesterday's 8 and today's 8 together. And I remember I was waiting for the guy to pull out the checkered flag or pull out the last lap sign. And it was hot and it was dehydrated. I know exactly what you're talking about.
Dude, in fact, I remember, I was kind of trash talking the entire weekend. Because I believe in the law of attraction. I mean, more power to the universe, and I kind of
manifest
say it out loud.
Win.
Yeah, manifest to win. So I was like, I don't give a shit. I've not raced before, but I'm going to win this. And I kept trash talking all these guys. I'm going to win this. So I kept trash talking all the other competitors. And I was like super high on energy before the race started. But as soon as the race ended, as soon as it got over, I rolled into the pit. I felt like a dead man. Like I was done for the
day. Yes.
I just wanted to maybe find a nice bed and just doze off. I was dead, dude. I was completely out of energy.
Yeah.
But
I remember getting off the bike and Anand was there and Srikant was there and they were like hugging me, congratulating me, and I almost just wanted to like, you know, just lean on them and just be like, yo, I need 30 seconds, man. I need 30 seconds. I'm not going to be able to speak to you so fast.
Yeah, man. And but I think now if I go racing, I will still have that adrenaline, but I don't think it's going to be as much as it was during the first race.
Mm-hmm. I don't think it'll overwhelm us as much I think this time around.
Yeah, that's the correct word, I feel. Are you following MotoGP?
I am following MotoGP very closely, man. This is my first year trying MotoGP Fantasy. So I've been following practice sessions. I've been following weather reports. Yeah, I've been following it pretty close this year.
So are you following just MotoGP or are you keeping an eye on the lower classes as well?
No, I definitely keep an eye on Moto 2 and 3. I'm definitely biased towards Moto 3. Unbelievable action in Moto 3. I don't know why. I'm a little less interested in Moto 2. I've never been really able to wrap my head around Moto 2. But I love Moto 3 and I love MotoGP.
Yeah, dude. I mean, I've always maintained this and said this in a lot of my podcasts that I enjoy Moto 3 more than MotoGP. I mean, and it's only because when you're about to start the last lap, there are 7, 8, 10, 12 people and you don't know who's going to win. So if you have to bet money on someone, it's always going to be unbelievable. I mean, looking at Pedro Acosta at what he did through the entire season, looking at some of the other riders as well, you know, when you enter the last lap, you're 7th or 8th and then you end up winning the race. Yeah. It's unbelievable in some of the races, but I've always maintained that Moto 3 is the best class when it comes to competition.
That comes, it almost comes down to saying that Moto 3, because it's such a level playing field in terms of you take away budget caps, you take away technology, you take away all these things. The only thing you're left with is the rider and pure competition.
And talent, yeah. I mean, it's just that.
Yeah.
Who are you rooting for in Moto 3?
Oh, to be very honest with you, I'm on this wave of that Pedro Acosta has created. Only because I can't believe, I mean, that guy is so young. He's like 16 or 17.
16,
And the confidence that he has to, I mean, I think one race, pre-race interview, he said, I'll play with them for 20 laps and then end up winning or something like that. To that tune. And it's just unbelievable to see somebody that young be so sure of himself and prove it also. It's not that he's just empty talk and with nothing to back it up.
100%. And I think MotoGP as well, when you look, I mean, you know, that and the reason why I say I like Moto3 as much is because of the competition. If I'm being a big fan of Marc Marquez, there was a certain period in time where he was super dominant and there was just no competition. And in spite of being a massive fan of that guy, I kind of got bored of this whole sport where, you know, you have one individual who's kind of running away and then there's just no fun in it. Last year was super interesting. Yeah, yeah. This year as well, it's going to be close. I mean, Quartararo has kind of taken off, but I think as the season progresses, there's going to be quite a bit of competition creeping in.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Who do you think, who are you betting your money on for MotoGP?
MotoGP, I think Quartararo has it, man, this year. And to be honest with you, I think the big difference in Quartararo between last year and this year is his mental state of mind.
Correct.
I think he looks like a rock. It looks like you cannot shake him right now.
Yeah.
And I feel the big difference between somebody like Vinales and Quartararo right now is nothing more than just their mental state.
100%.
It's unbelievable how close everybody is in talent, how close all the bikes are. You see 8 by 10 bikes 1 second away from each other. Qualifying is unbelievable sometimes. And the thing that separates, I think, the guy from first place to even the guy in eighth place in that 1 second gap is just who is able to come out there with the most confidence and prove himself on that day.
Correct. Also, I think between the 2020 end of the 2020 season and the start of the 2021 season, Cortararo actually paid a visit to a sports psychologist.
Yeah.
I don't know the kind of chat that goes on inside the room, but I'm sure it's definitely focused towards a lot of the mental preparation, getting a lot of the things in your head sorted, figuring out confidence, figuring out a way not to lose focus during the race. Because if you see the last season, there was a point where everybody thought Marquez is not here. Quartararo had a fantastic start to the season. Mm-hmm. And everybody thought he's going to run away and ultimately did not even finish as the runner-up, which is kind of a bummer for me. And I think it's a lot to do, like you said, a lot to do with the mental game. So I think this break that he took between the two seasons, visiting someone who could actually help him get better mentally, which is so important, I think that's showing in the year 2021. So absolutely, he's been a firecracker. Racing, Rishi, is there, you've been on the track a lot of times. Is there a particular diet that you've been following?
Particular diet, to be honest with you, my story is a little different. I am a heavy sort of ectomorph. So I struggle to put on muscle, struggle to put on weight.
Correct.
Been really lucky my whole life. Lucky and unlucky, man, sometimes. Lucky and unlucky. Yeah. I feel I grew up playing basketball.
Correct.
Struggled a lot, in terms of being able to throw my weight around or use my weight effectively. In college, I got really serious about my diet, about working out, about getting fit. And I spent four and a half years solid diet, four and a half meals a day, really tracking my, macronutrients, working out six times a week. And it showed results. So I went from, I was 55 kg when I started college. I'm 6'3". I was really skinny. And by the time I graduated college, I was 70, 72. So really saw some results in that. So that sort of set the tone for, I would say, my 20s. Where even now, I'm not really particularly working out every day or doing something every day, but I like to be physically active. And in that, I like to really maintain a simple diet. I don't eat much junk. I don't snack, to be honest. I don't drink too many juices or anything like that. I stay hydrated and I eat simple home-cooked food, lots of veggies, a good amount of protein and carbs. I keep it simple, basically, is what I'm trying to say. But I definitely, it's an effort on my end. It's not something that happens just naturally. It's definitely something that's been on the back of my mind. And then something I do, whether I'm doing something physically active or not, I try and keep my diet constant.
You've been on the racing circuit. I mean, of course, Bangalore is pretty close to Chennai and Coimbatore as well. So I'm sure you've been on the racetrack as a spectator more than a couple of times. And you've seen our Indian racers go at it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think just because of the way our sport is perceived and the kind of thought or the kind of financial power that goes into it, I mean, just by that, you can already see the difference just in terms of stature, just in terms of physical health between a racer who is in India and someone who is training internationally. And this might sound harsh to a lot of people who are listening to this podcast, but it is the truth. I mean, you cannot keep eating random things throughout the day. Of course, the racing bit is a different situation, but when you supplement it with a good diet and not just diet, with a good mental coach as well, I think things improve, you become better. And that is what is lacking in India right now, which is sort of surprising because there are some really talented individuals who I've seen at the racetrack belonging to different camps. And some of these individuals have the potential to represent India. I mean, some of them have, like Jagan Kumar has gone to ARRC. Who is the Honda guy? I can't remember his name.
You're talking about
Jagan's main competitor.
He did Idimetsu this thing, right?
Correct. Can't remember his name, but
the name will come to me.
Yeah, but those individuals are actually. They're talented, dude. I've seen him race at ARRC in the Australian round. And, racing is one thing, but diet and fitness and nutrition. I mean, you can still be fit, but what about nutrition? You don't have enough sponsors from nutrition who are willing to invest in these guys for whatever reason. But I think it's super necessary for someone, for because I feel this is all a part of athletics. And for an athlete, you will spend a lot of your time in the kitchen just building up your build, just getting fitter, just getting just paying a lot more attention to what goes inside your stomach. So in that scenario, I feel I think India is lacking quite a bit behind. But that's the story and it is what it is.
And I don't think it's exclusive to just motorsport either. I mean, if you see our Indian competitors in any sport, if you see look at them in basketball, hockey, or any other sport, I mean, you do see there is a common underlying tone of Indian athletes probably being a little on the, I don't want to say smaller side.
Correct.
But you, like you said, the physical stature, I mean, you can see the difference between international competition and ours. I don't know how much of that comes down to genetics, but also probably years of not receiving the right, I mean, probably advice or input information. I think when we were in a basketball state camp, we were given like a glass of milk and an egg in the morning after practice.
Really?
And that used to be like the thing, like a plain glass of milk and a boiled egg.
Wow.
And that used to be a thing, right? You have to have that. That if you don't have that, then like, you're not going to be able to compete. Was sort of the mentality everyone had.
Correct.
But it's more than that, right? It's obviously more than just a glass of milk and egg.
Yeah. Also, when I look at, you know, I've had plenty opportunities to talk to international riders, and because I feel they're the elite class. I mean, if they're not paying attention to the diet, then who will? So I've always had this opportunity to talk to some of these people, but instead of asking for a status about their season or what their bike is and all of that, I am very curious about what they eat, what they do in their free time. Are they junking? Are they chomping on food? I mean, because they're traveling constantly, right? So keeping a very close eye on what goes inside their body is also a task. I mean, of course, they have a team who supplements them with some of the other things. But again, you're traveling, man, and your body's trying to adjust to different time zones across the year. So I've been very curious. Unfortunately, I've never gotten the chance to ask them that. But I am going to make it a point and ask if I get a chance ever, I'm going to ask them what their diet includes and what their fitness includes. Now, when you were talking about riding fitness, were there particular exercises that you were doing? Because when you're riding a motorcycle, I think one of the things that I have researched on and one of the things that I come across very often is just building your core. Building your core, strengthening your back. It does not necessarily involve a lot of heavy lifting, you know, making biceps bulge like crazy, having like a huge pumped up chest. But I think the focus is more on the core, the back, the legs, because all of this is really involved when you're bull riding a motorcycle. So is there a particular set of exercises that you follow?
You know, when I first started riding bikes at the track, which was in 2015, late 2015, early 2016, I didn't realize how intense the pressure or the load is on your legs, on the lower half of the body. It literally does 80% of the work for you. And I had no idea that you have to hug the bike that tight with your legs when you're accelerating, use it to prevent yourself from falling forward when you're braking, when you're leaning off the bike, there's no weight on the handlebars, you know, it's all on the legs. So really, I mean, 80% of the work is happening below your waist and below, right? And that's something I had no idea about. I was fortunate that at the time, like I said, I was pretty, strict with my workouts, my diet, etc. And I was sort of strong enough to be able to adjust and deal with those forces. But like you're saying, I had to make a lot of adjustments when I started doing regular track days, when I realized it isn't just about showing up in the morning, warming up your bike, going. You better stretch. You better, you know, do your mobility. You better do hip mobility. You better do some good stretches. I mean, your glutes, your hamstrings, your adductors, abductors, those are so important for like to strengthen them, activate them a little bit before riding. These things, I think, have experience of 1 or 2 years of doing just a bunch of practice came in super handy before doing a race, where I knew not only did my bike have to be up to the mark, but also when I showed up that my body had to be up to the mark. And similarly, now, because of these lockdowns and other things, I've started riding a lot more dirt. And in dirt, it's been again like learning from ground zero almost. It feels like, luckily I have some experience now with track when I know what to expect. I know what arm pump feels like, or I know what tight glutes or hips feel like on a bike.
Correct.
I was kind of we were having this little discussion before the podcast started. Hadn't ridden it for about 2 months.
Mm-hmm.
At all. Mm-hmm. And then I went to ride some dirt last weekend, and I couldn't do more than 3 laps at a time because I just couldn't hug the bike with my legs. You stand up and you go these jumps, you get arm pump when you whack the throttle open and the bike's trying to rip you off. And I just couldn't do more than 3 laps. And it's not just a physical ability, it's also mentally you have to be tuned in. And as you start getting more and more exhausted when you're standing up, you're taking those jumps, whoops, the ruts, you start physically exhausted, you start getting winded, and then you're not thinking, you're not focusing, you know, you're missing your markers. It becomes more of a physical struggle with the bike as opposed to something that should really be just flowing naturally. And that, again, I think is to do with, I just wasn't fit. I wasn't bike fit. I might have been able to do 10 push-ups, 10 pull-ups or whatever, but I wasn't bike fit, right? I wasn't ready to experience the forces that you actually feel on a bike.
Correct. Also, I think when you look at Quartararo's physique, he's got like really, he's not got the broadest shoulders, but mm-hmm. he's got really thick legs. His upper body is not that big, but he's got a really good lower body. I mean, of course, every MotoGP mm-hmm. rider has got a six-pack. But I think what really, if you're a motorcycle racer, lift your shirt and you'll see a six-pack. But I think the one thing to notice is that some of these riders have actually got really well-built legs. They do a lot mm-hmm. of cycling. And I think once they're at the track on Thursday, you will see a lot of these BTS pictures where riders are on the racetrack trying to just understand what the track feels like, just get a feel of the track in terms of air, see their markers. Yeah. And, you know, this is like a warm-up session on a cycle rather than a motorcycle. And a lot of these riders actually focus on their lower body. So it's great to see that. But what makes these guys alien for me is getting this sort of concentration lap after lap, every lap for 25, 26, 28 laps in some circuits. That is what makes them alien.
Absolutely.
I mean,
it's unbelievable.
Yeah, dude, it's unbelievable.
I think to be a successful MotoGP rider or to even be at any level of competitive motorcycle racing, it requires that almost perfect trifecta of not just cardiovascular dominance, strength, and conditioning. Because there's so many minor muscles that we don't use in our everyday lives. And you hear about the F1 drivers pulling 5Gs and then the necks having to deal with G-forces. You hear about, you see on footage of someone like Rossi and you can see the vein sticking out of his neck when he's on the corner, right? The jugular vein. And even when you ride, arm pump, that's not something you'd experience in your everyday life. To have to deal with that, and to have to deal with your heart rate being at 130 for 45 minutes to an hour, or 140. You really do need like the perfect trifecta of physical conditioning.
Yeah. And I think that is why this progression from Moto 3 to a slightly bigger motorcycle in Moto 2 and finally jumping onto the big daddy, which is a MotoG bike. I think that is why this progression is needed. No matter the talent, you cannot jump straight to a MotoGP motorcycle and, you know, bullied around a racetrack. It's just not possible. Understanding the kind of forces that are applied to your body in Moto 3 are completely different from Moto 2 and Moto GP. So I think this progression is a nice step up for riders. Mm-hmm. And through the course of these years, these riders also tend to develop those muscles, train those muscles in understanding what really happens when you're braking hard, what really happens when you're mm-hmm. accelerating hard, how to hold the motorcycle even more effectively. Because every motorcycle is different in every class. It's really personalized to your feedback. I think this progression makes a lot of sense. And MotoGP, when you look at the spec sheet of a MotoGP bike, I had the fortune of being inside Rossi and Vinales' garage when I was in Bangkok a couple of years ago. Yamaha had taken us for the unveil of their M1 M1, I mean, for the year, for the M1 for the year. Mm-hmm. And we were told not to click any pictures because everything that was inside the pit was a prototype. Every single thing. So we were asked not to take pictures, and we had the opportunity to click, you know, stand beside the motorcycle, kind of see. And I couldn't, I mean, you understand this, you understand the fork, you understand the shock, you understand the brake. But how you and I understand it is, it is completely different. What do you see on a motorcycle?
I'm sure we're not even scratching the surface of what these people are doing.
100%. Trying to wrestle a 170 kilo motorcycle, which is making close to 300 HP, for those many laps requires immense skill. But I think apart from the physical strength, like we were talking about earlier in the podcast, the mental preparation also has to be insane. I don't know how many of these guys do yoga, but I'm sure some of these guys do it, because when your heart is pumping at 160 beats per minute, and you're trying to figure out a way to stay ahead of the pack, and if there's someone who's charging at you and trying to constantly battle with that individual, yet you're trying to find that marker, the correct braking marker, going around the corner, getting on the throttle at the correct time. I think it requires years of experience for sure. But doing that in a live race, no matter the experience, you're always going to be a little jittery. But dude, one thing, I've seen these BPM graphs of many riders. Jack Miller's usually racing at 180. Dude, Vinales is like so calm, dude.
Rock solid. He's 120. No, like he doesn't leave 120 for him. I mean, I don't know what he's doing. His cardiovascular conditioning must be another level. This guy's race beats per minute is almost like Gigi Delinea or Pablo Ciabatti's like trackside beats per minute. These two Ducatis are going at it.
Dude, I've always thought that there's a problem with his heart rate monitor. Maybe it was a one race thing or a two race thing or a three race thing, but it's been through years. I mean, for the past two or three years, it's always been that. He's never exceeded it. I just fail to understand why he doesn't get it right on race day. But
which is so unusual, confusing, I think, to us MotoGP fans. It would make sense if he was nervous about something and his heart rate reflected that. Hmm. The heart rate seems to be constant, even if he gaffs the start, loses a couple of positions, fights his way back to the field. I mean, it just does not waver from there, which is so surprising to see.
100%, dude. I mean, I'm sure all of these guys are actually going to sports psychologists and, you know, talking to them. What do you think they might be talking about?
I think from what I've understood, because a few friends of mine in college used to be sports psychologists, because we had a pretty competitive basketball team. I did my college in the US, and our basketball team was sort of like a Division I team that took part in this NCAA tournament year. So I had a couple of friends who were on the team. I just talked to them about it. From what they tell me, it was basically everyday scenarios reiterated through a sports lens.
Okay.
So if you have insecurities about your physical stature, for example,
mm-hmm.
It could be manifesting its way in certain ways through the sports lens.
Okay.
A tennis player could be giving up if he's down two sets, and if it's a three set game, he's down two sets, he might be wanting to give up. But the reason he's giving up could be linked to some insecurity he has in his personal life, for example. So a lot of the sports psychologists' target was to look at the end result, which was, okay, you're struggling to do this on the basketball court or on the track.
Correct.
And then start stemming backwards to see why is that from your personal life manifesting itself in your sport, which I thought was crazy, which is not something I thought. I mean, the link to me didn't make sense until they explained to me what procedure was like and what that conversation was like. And you could really see that once they had a good rapport with the sports psychologist, once that person was able to understand them better, and they had a few sessions, you could see their game improving. You could see their, not just their final game, but, you know, they'd show up to practice happier. They would put in more effort. You know, the relationship with their team members, people around them improves. So all in all, I think it boosts, it just boosts the entire team's stature up to another level.
Do you have an example that you want to share?
Not personally. I mean, these were just stories I heard from players on the basketball team at the time.
Okay.
But I think a lot of the players who used to play on the basketball team weren't, I mean, they didn't come from any privileged backgrounds. A lot of them grew up quite poor. A lot of them grew up maybe in a single parent household. So there were some insecurities about that. There were complexes like that they developed through their childhood, maybe. And a lot of that used to manifest itself, like maybe a fear to fail.
Correct.
Or a fear of public speaking, or fear of not being enough for the team or for your coach, or disappointing someone. And that manifests itself in ways of, like, you just end up skipping practice, or if you were not doing well that season, or you'd damage, like, I could imagine maybe a MotoGP player blaming the tire, or blaming the team, or blaming the bike for probably a mistake that they made. I could see this manifest from the stories I've heard from these players, but
correct.
That's as specific as I could probably get with that.
Yeah. Because I think last year when you see Quartararo fall through the ranks and how the rest of, I mean, especially the second half of how the second half of the season progressed for him, you could really see him not in his element. I mean, when the season started, he was like a precision rider, winning the first two races at Jerez with comfortable margins and just being the perfect rider in terms of getting your points right, getting your throttle right, not making a mistake for during a race and having like the perfect race weekend. But through the second half, you sort of realized he's panicking is what I felt. That was a general emotion that I had. He was panicking. He knew the title was kind of slipping away from his hands. And probably that might have hampered the rest of his season. But when you look at Marc Márquez this season, go on, Rishi.
Yeah. Sorry, I think with Quartararo, especially since he's such an animated character, you could see that in qualifying FP. Like if he made a mistake in FP2, you see him punching the air, being really animated about it. Or you could see him get full position and absolutely scream his lungs out to his helmet. And that sort of already, I think, showed the viewer who, when we watched that this person could be a little bit of a hot and cold sort of a dimension. And then you don't see that this year. You see him much more calm, much more relaxed, accepting failures as well as he accepts successes.
Yeah,
you're right. Sorry, you were saying about Márquez?
Yeah, I was talking about Márquez and when he came back this year, I was talking to I had a podcast with a couple of fellow colleagues from the industry who work for different publications. And we were all discussing about Marc Márquez and we kind of at one point in time realized that and we spoke of this and we said that he might just come and win it. And when when the podcast got over, I kind of sat back and I realized, it can't happen. It cannot happen. I mean, just to overcome the mental, I mean, of course, he's got nerve damage and, if he's not, doesn't have strength and he had not been on a MotoGP motorcycle for a good amount of time. And just to get used to that feeling of a MotoGP motorcycle, plus it was not built to his liking. It was more built for Paul Espargaró because he was not testing the motorcycle as much.
Mm-hmm.
So when the motorcycle is not built to his liking, he'll take a while to just figure it out. Some of them are so confident, they actually put Marc Márquez in the fantasy team in the very first race that he came.
That was surprising to me.
I kind of saw the Marquez magic at Le Mans. Before he crashed, I was like, oh, he's got it this year. He's got it this year.
That was scary, yeah?
That was scary.
Conditions and you suddenly see him say, okay,
becoming the old Marquez. Unfortunately, he crashed. But I think that Barcelona test, where they tried out new things, they tried out new winglet. I think they tried out new swing arm as well. And now they are trying to make the motorcycle more towards Marc Márquez's liking. And when he came back at Sachsenring and when he won the race, you could just see the outburst of emotions that he had. Absolutely. It just meant so much to him winning that race, especially at Sachsenring. But I think that is where that emotional barrier was also overcome because as a rider, you have this this weight on your shoulders that you're carrying. I mean, it's the pressure of the fans, it's the pressure of the company, it's the pressure of your parents, it's your own pressure, that's that weight you're carrying on your motorcycle, that you have to perform at a certain level. And when Marc Márquez actually did it, he kind of, I felt he crossed that barrier and said, I'm good now. So it was amazing to see that. Yes. But I think when you put two and two together, everything matters. I mean, physical, mental, emotional, you have to be in the right place. Because one of these things might go wrong. And that is why very few riders also excel at this sport. I mean, you can blame it on the motorcycle as much as you want, but ultimately it's the rider that matters as well.
I was reading Rossi's book. I've read it like twice or thrice now.
Correct.
And early in his career, when he was clearly quicker than Biaggi, I think you could see, obviously he writes it from his perspective, so he's going to make himself sound good. But correct. You could see Biaggi sort of unraveling when correct. He used to first sort of blame, when he was in Yamaha, he used to say, no, the Yamaha's a shit bike. And then correct. The year when 2004 switched, and then Rossi was in the Yamaha, and Yamaha ends up winning. I mean, you could really, when you're at that limit, like we said earlier, when you're at that peak, everything matters. The guy who shows up with the most confidence, or the guy who's feeling good that day, you know, the guy who had a good nap before the race, it could be anything. Whatever just pushes you over the limit for that final 10th or the final 100th.
Dude, did you see Jack Miller this season? I mean,
I've been watching him really closely this season.
Yeah, dude. I mean, if you saw his pit walkout, even during the qualifying session, or even during the practice sessions, he used to be super pumped. Like, he used to like thump his chest, massive fist bump to his colleagues and all of that. So you could see that sort of confidence as well. And maybe, you know, Cal Crutchlow's wife also is sending him like positive messages and all of that. Honestly, dude, it works. You know, when you have, 100%, dude, I'm telling you, I believe in the law of attraction. And when there's another body that's supporting you and pushing you to get closer to the thing of yours, it 100% works, dude. And it worked for Jack Miller for the cup, for the two races that he won. And it was incredible, man.
I think you are a product of people that you surround yourself with. I think this year, line, I think we're looking at Jack Miller, the adult, and not Jack Miller, the child. I think him skipping Moto2 and going to MotoGP, he was still a child, man. People expect him to act like an adult, be mature, ride a bike. I mean, but you were still a kid going from Moto3 to MotoGP. It's not easy. And I think it's taken him a little longer than it would have taken him if he went through the traditional route. I think this year we're looking at really Jack Miller, the grown-up, and not 100%. Jack Miller, you know, pre-adolescent, adolescent.
I absolutely agree. And also, I think one of the things that I would like to point out is that not only are these riders racing through Friday, I mean, riding a MotoGP motorcycle through Friday, Saturday and Sunday, they also have to remove some time for family. They also have to remove some time for themselves. They also have to remove a lot of time for sponsors and the press. So their schedule is jam-packed, and it does get tiring at some point in time. And of course, there's a huge paycheck that comes at the end of every month. I don't know how it functions for racers, if it's for per race or it's a yearly thing, but there's a huge paycheck that comes, but you have to back that paycheck up with a whole host of other responsibilities. So it's a tough game, dude. And I have been an athletic individual throughout my life, and I've, you know, been a part of many sports through my schooling, through college and beyond that as well. I still enjoy playing football, and I personally feel I'm slightly good at it. But it just, I mean, being an athlete requires its own set of commitments. And when you do that, or when you pick that up as your job, I think it's very important to stay committed to it. And I think journalism as well, automotive journalism, when you're riding a motorcycle, you cannot be a fat fuck, man. You cannot be someone who is completely unhealthy and, you know, talk about fucking suspension and comfort. You cannot talk about this shit, dude. I get damn mad at my industry colleagues, and I am very open to criticizing them and shit like that, but it's you cannot convince a potential buyer how good a motorcycle is if you're a fat fuck. You cannot. I'm not body shaming.
The bluntest I've ever heard being said in my life.
No, honestly, I'm not body shaming. Being fat is not healthy. It is not healthy. Being fat has its own complications. So I'm not body shaming, mm-hmm. but this is the absolute truth. When you lose weight and when you start dropping those kilos, you feel good about yourself. You feel light. Your mood is better. Your sleep is better. Your sexual life is better. So I think it's so important to stay fit. And that applies in the case of automotive journalism as well. And I think massive props to Shumi. I don't know if you've seen Shumi lately, but he's dropped a shitload of weight.
He's ready, dog. He's really working out in the off season.
Yeah, dude. He's lost like 12, 13, 14 odd kilos. So,
my goodness.
Yeah, he used to weigh as much as me, but he's dropped like a shitload of weight. And he feels so good about it. So good about it. And that's the beauty mm-hmm. of it. You cannot tell me.
It's addictive.
It's addictive, dude. When those hormones start releasing and, you know, when your brain gets, you know, filled up with those happy hormones, you feel good, dude.
Dopamine.
100%, man. Dopamine or endorphins or whatever the shit hormones are. But you cannot be unhealthy and talk about and ride a motorcycle and have an opinion. I think it's completely uncool. Anyway, that's a completely different topic. I would love to jam more on this on another day. But on an ending note, who have you got in your fantasy league?
Whoa. Okay, so last race. So I had Miguel Oliveira coming into the race with Quartararo.
Mm-hmm.
I had Johan Zarco and Miller.
Fabio and Miguel were your gold riders.
Fabio and Miller. Fabio and for the previous race, it was Fabio, Vinales, Miguel, and Johan Zarco. Jack Miller.
But
I had a difficult choice for the previous race. I had to choose between dropping either Miller or Zarco to
previous race. And by that you mean the Dutch TT or the Saxon Ring?
The one before Saxon Ring.
Okay.
So I had to drop one of them to get Vinales in because I knew Vinales was going to do well.
Okay.
I dropped Johan Zarco and kept Miller. Miller ended up crashing. Okay. Zarco ended up doing quite well. I mean, I think I'm doing pretty well. I think me and my friend Varun, we're both Varun Nari, mm-hmm. Narayanan. He's in the league with me as well. And we're sort of 3.5-4 points away from each other. I mean, I think our India rank is like some... It at one point went up like 60. So we were really happy with ourselves.
What?
Like,
we were doing
quite well. Yeah. So we were doing quite well. And we haven't used many of our times 3 or times 2 bonuses.
The Motul
so
boost.
Far. I think we both used only one each. Motul boost, yep. We only used one each so far.
Dude, I've used the Motul boost twice on Fabio Quartararo once when he had the perfect weekend at Jerez.
Arm pump weekend?
Dude, that's the same
week. Me too, man. That
and
is
I had
so
like,
frustrating.
Dude, what a weekend that was for Quartararo. And come race day and arm pump kicks in and it just went.
That was so frustrating, man.
And the second one I used was... You had it on Marquez as well?
I didn't have it. I didn't have Marquez in my team for Saxon Ring. I would have used him.
Yeah.
I think I'm going to somehow creep Marquez into my team before Kota and then use a Motul boost at Kota.
Yeah, for sure. and the second Motul boost that I used was again for Quartararo at Le Mans, if I'm not wrong. But I think Le Mans turned out to be Catalunya.
Okay.
Catalunya. I used it there. In the order, he finished third, but then he had like a penalty. So he finished fourth and then he had some more penalties and he finished sixth. So two Motul boost buttons are done and dusted, dude. Such a pity.
That's difficult, man.
Dude, for Saxon Ring, you won't believe this, but for Saxon Ring, I actually had Morbidelli in the team. And I don't know, like with a minute to go for the round to go live, I actually removed Morbidelli and got Marquez in. I did not have him as a gold rider. I did not have him as a gold rider. I had him as a silver rider, but I had him on the team and boom, wins the race.
Dude, I don't know why. I early in the season, I had a lot riding on Morbidelli and I stuck with him for a couple of races. When he did,
I did
better,
too.
Hoping he's better. I think that's what's like biggest disappointment of the season for me, man. Unfortunately, I think if he just had a factory spec Yamaha, this guy would be on another planet right now.
So in the previous episode, I spoke of the entire grid and where I think people fit in. And I think Morbidelli might get upgraded to the factory team for Yamaha.
Yeah.
I think the Aramco team might have Bezzecchi and Marini. KTM will be joined. So Gardner, and I think they will retrieve Petrucci because I think they need one experienced rider in the team. So I think Lecuona goes out and Petrucci fits in Tech 3. And Raul Fernandez, and it's either going to be Augusto Fernandez accompanying him or Joe Roberts or who was it? Javi Vier, who's a Moto2 Petronas rider. I think he's going to give him company. So that's, yeah, I think that's going to be the lineup for MotoGP. I don't know how that goes.
I'm really interested in seeing how the Petronas team fills their seats because they have a lot of riders coming up. To be honest, I think Yamaha struggles with talent management, man. I don't know why. I feel like sometimes they miss the bus on some talent. I don't think they are the quickest manufacturer to react. I mean, in terms of their technical department, in terms of human resources. Unfortunately, I feel like that's their Achilles heel.
And I think KTM does it so well. I mean, you just look at the lineup. Unbelievable. Like, they just have an eye for these talented individuals. I mean, right from Acosta to Raul Fernandez, who's a goddamn rookie, dude. Figuring out how Remy Gardner could be a good fit. I mean, he did not have the best season last year, but just giving him him that factory that KTM ticket for Moto2 and just seeing him perform the way he is performing, and then finally makes his way to MotoGP next year. So KTM's got a really good eye for that. But next season is going to be super interesting, man.
I think the last few seasons MotoGP has done. I mean, Dorna has done so well to make MotoGP competitive and interesting. So many manufacturers. I think Kawasaki is the only manufacturer really that's missing from the action.
BMW,
yeah. But I guess BMW for them, MotoGP will be a totally different product. I think Kawasaki still has some heritage in GP.
Correct.
I think for BMW to get into MotoGP is difficult, man. I don't see that R&D and that investment in MotoGP trickling down there.
No, I don't think so. And I think Kawasaki is really happy winning WSBK titles with Rhea. So
yeah, exactly.
I don't see them coming.
I would really love to see Toprak, man. If he moves to MotoGP,
dude, that Toprak's would be leading the championship, by the way.
After three points, I think. Fall.
Three points or something.
That guy would be interesting in MotoGP, man. He seems like he's a little bit of. Like, he has what it takes to, you know?
He's a little bit of a wild child, I feel.
Yeah.
I mean, if you see him entering corners and all, he's always sliding. Yeah. He's all over the place, cutting inside and all of that. So, I don't know how tire management will abide by him in when it comes to MotoGP.
If you notice, all the Turkish riders are like this. Keenan was like this, Toprak, even the two Onçu
brothers. Yeah, Dennis, and...
It seems to be sort of like a Turkish thing almost. Like, they don't know where the dirt ends and where the asphalt starts. They seem to be using the same...
Yeah, dude. Sipping some asphalt. Turkish tea and having those kebabs is definitely helping. But awesome, dude. Thank you so much for being a part of this, Rishi. I really appreciate you taking some time out.
It's really my honor, man. Really.
I would actually love to do this again with you. Maybe decode one of the races in the coming weeks. They're on a summer break, obviously.
Oh, sure.
Maybe one of the races at Austria. That's going to be an interesting couple of weekends in August. Yeah. So I really look forward to that. But thank you so much for now. Any final parting words?
Thank you so much, man. I just want to say thanks, dude. I think this initiative of yours, I needed something like this, to be honest. I really look forward to listening to your podcast. I like listening to MotoGP banter because it's relatable to me, but it's a world that I really enjoy.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's a perfect mix of that Venn diagram. It's people I understand and it's concepts that I understand and it's a world that I really enjoy. So thanks for the initiative. Thanks for doing something like this. Thanks for having me, man. Really such an honor to be here.
Super, man.
Hopefully, we'll do some more in the future.
100%. I would love to have you back. But for now, thank you so much once again. That was Rishi Agarwal, who's been an awesome guest on this podcast. And we're going to do this again. But for now, we are shutting down episode number 13 of MotoGP Banter. This is season 2. My name is Warren Painter. That was Rishi Agarwal. See you soon.